the 2001 Disclosure Project witnesses that Stephen Greer got to come forward was Mark McCandlish. And I know you got to talk and work with Mark a bit. And of course, he had an encounter, or he was told about three anti-gravity devices that were shown at an air show in 1988. They were operational and they appeared to be there on display for potential customers. And they seemed to be based on this electrogravitic effect.
That's actually a very interesting story overall. And I'm interested in showing one of the examples of that. It's in the second volume of Electrogravitics 2, an illustration of the saucer that we're talking about. And Mark's illustration of that. We have one here that is almost similar. Perhaps this is a 1950s example of one that's declassified. What he called it is reproduction, alien reproduction vehicle, ARV. What it contained on the very bottom were a whole bunch of different sections, very similar to this drawing, although not the same, of sections of capacitor banks. Well, that turns out to be a confirmation of my Electrogravitics 2 book describing electrokinetics, pulsed electrokinetics. And as Mark told me, three sections in a kind of a star-shaped triangular form would be fired at any one time and then moved over to the next section, and so forth. So it constantly produced a downward force, or in other words, an upward reaction force on the vehicle. Brad Sorensen's eyewitness report was a couple of these 1950s rivet type of structures were actually levitating in the closed environment at Norton Air Force Base.
You're listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala, your source for the uncensored truth regarding the human, extraterrestrial, global, and political agenda. Click the like button and subscribe to this channel. And now, here's Dr. Michael Sala.
It's my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Tom Vallone to Exopolitics Today. I've known Dr. Vallone for nearly 20 years. I think we met at one of the early X conferences that were organized by Stephen Bassett in Washington, D.C. And he was doing some really interesting work in alternative energy, and he was also involved or working at the U.S. Patents Office. So I want to welcome Dr. Vallone to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, I know that you, prior to working at the Patent and Trademark Office, spent, I think, close to 20 years as an engineer, as a teaching applied physics at different community colleges and working as a professional engineer. And sometime during that, you got interested in alternative energy or future energy. And as I recall, I think it was during your master's degree that you got interested in future energy and Nikola Tesla. So kind of like, what was it that sparked your interest in the work of Tesla and future energy?
Well, if we want to tell the whole story, I grew up in Western New York, in Buffalo, New York, actually, and Niagara Falls essentially, you know, was 20 minutes away. So for a 1986 Tesla conference, I did some research on the history of Nikola Tesla in Niagara Falls. And it turns out that 1895 was the key date when electricity was generated at the falls by Tesla's new turbines. And they essentially were lined up to broadcast and connect it with the Edison power lines to Buffalo, New York. So in 1896, the electricity was turned on for the first time 20 miles away. And so I researched at the Niagara Falls Library the actual interviews with Tesla and so forth, and I actually found the site of the original Adams plant in Niagara Falls. So I made a whole slideshow of it. And it's actually in my book, Harnessing the Real Work of Nature, which is, might as well show it off if it shows up in my virtual background, possibly. Anyways, the important part is that this is a collection of Tesla articles, wireless transmission of power. And essentially, ever since my 1980 trip to Germany for a gravity field conference, I found that even the homopolar generator, which was the subject of my master's degree, was actually an article that Tesla published as well. So this was another area that Tesla had already been there. In other words, in both the high voltage work that I was interested in, the Tesla coil discoveries, which, by the way, became a very popular medical field of endeavor right after 1895. Because the electricity and the alternating current form was now available actually throughout the country within 1 year. It was amazing how it proliferated to other generating stations very quickly after the generation from Niagara Falls to Buffalo.
Can you maybe just explain what a Tesla coil is? Because I know that's at the heart of Tesla technologies and the applications, multiple applications of it. And so you can maybe just explain what are the key characteristics of it? How does it work?
Actually, what I would be happy to show and share a screen of is my two different Tesla coil devices that actually, we have three of them, but the two major ones use a 250,000 volt coil. And essentially, the first one is the most, I would say, common application of a Tesla coil, and that is the Lakowski design. So picture is worth a thousand words. And if I go ahead and click on share screen, we'll see if one of my screens, there we go, can actually show you the, we call it the Premier 2000. And it's essentially the bottom part is the primary coil. And then we have the Tesla coil itself, which is the 500 turn coil on top, and then various gold, silver, and copper, basically different rings that amplify the frequencies that Lakowski is famous for. So a Tesla coil is really just a transformer, and it takes a spark gap to introduce, I would say, a chaotic component to the circuitry, so that you have a random mix of lots of frequencies. And in the bioelectromagnetic healing book in the back, I actually show an article by Toby Groats where he analyzed the frequency range of the Tesla coil. And it has kilohertz, megahertz, and gigahertz. That's what's interesting about a Tesla coil, a wide bandwidth of frequencies that actually the body, as it turns out in my other book, Bioelectromagnetic Healing, can absorb. And it can absorb the, I would say, quantum frequencies that it needs to store in DNA and therefore engage in biophoton communications. So this is basically the first one that I was referring to. And then, of course, there's also the Premier 4000, which is our chair model. And that's the, I would say, the more popular version. We've actually shipped two of them this week. There's a third order that'll be going out next week. And surprisingly, Nikola Tesla actually performed the, I would say, the surprising ability to light up a fluorescent light bulb in his hand when he was sitting on his Tesla chair. And so I decided to reproduce that effect into basically a Tesla coil in the base. And here's a little video showing the actual operation. And that's a fluorescent bulb in the hand. There you go. Oh, that's on YouTube as well. So hopefully that explains more than you expected for what a Tesla coil is.
Well, that's great, because I know it is a key part of what he was doing. And I know that, I mean, he was very interested in more than just providing power, that he also found that there was a kind of healing application. And you've kind of discussed that already. So what is it about electromagnetism and healing? Why is it that electromagnetism works when it comes to healing? I know you did some work with Robert Becker, author of Body Electric. So maybe that takes us into that body of work where, you know, there was some relationship found between good health or optimal health and electricity or electromagnetic currents. So you just explain why it is that electromagnetic healing works.
Sure. Actually, the best answer that I always tell audiences is when we're regarding the high voltage application of electrotherapy. However, there is the other pulsed electromagnetic version that I can refer to. The high voltage has two major aspects of why it works. And the first is that it boosts the transmembrane potential. The transmembrane potential is the outside of the living cells throughout their body. And the membrane that holds the cell together is one of the best insulators in the world. And this is so exciting to learn about, I've thought, because what happens is it can actually store 10 million volts per meter as an electrical gradient, or 100,000 volts per centimeter. And when I picture 10 million volts across a 1 meter distance, 10 million volts will short out and you'd have a lightning strike across that distance, if it's just air in between. However, with the lipid bilayer of the cell membrane, it actually ends up being incredibly good high voltage insulator. And that's what's also the one of two ways the body stores energy: electrical gradients or chemical gradients. And of course, we know lots about chemical gradients. Pharmaceutical company has capitalized on that. However, electrical gradients are new to us and only 100 years old in terms of the learning curve that we've experienced. And of course, it went through suppression through the FDA and AMA, as explained in the first chapter of my book, Electromagnetic Healing. However, the second feature that I was referring to, which is also available in post-EMF, is the fact that you should be aware of that electrons are antioxidants. And the fact that electrons are the key ingredients of antioxidants, whether in pill form or in this case, electrical form, means that it can quench free radicals that normally steal electrons from surrounding areas. And free radicals like to do that repeatedly, even, for example, as you take a shower in chlorinated water. Some of us live in cities that have chlorinated water, and if you're without a shower filter, you're basically bathing in chlorine gas. And the proof of that I've experienced when I had a salesman come to the house and actually show me a filter that he claimed would remove the chlorine. Well, the way he did it was he had me fill up a glass of water from the tap and put a drop of his chemical into the water. It turned yellow. So he said, that proves there's chlorine in the water. And then he said, now fill it up again and put your finger in the water, which I did for only about 10 seconds, maybe 20 seconds, put my finger out of the water, put a couple drops of his chemical in. it didn't turn yellow anymore. All the chlorine had gone into my fingers. I mean, this is an eye-opener for me. So when you're taking a shower, your skin actually is absorbing chlorine, free radical. It's a free radical, in other words. Oh, I forgot to tell you, the organic textbook, which I used in college, explains in one of the pages that chlorine gas, Cl2, will disassociate at body temperature, which is essentially what you're experiencing in a warm shower. So chlorine gas becomes Cl-, which is a free radical, and it replicates about 10,000 times. So there's the answer to two benefits of any type of electrotherapy, including high voltage therapy: the antioxidant effect of canceling and quenching free radicals, and also the boosting of the transmembrane potential, recharging the membrane, which is essentially like charging the battery with electricity.
So can you tell us a little bit about how you got to work with Robert Becker, author of The Body Electric? I know he did a lot of pioneering work in showing the applications and potential of electrotherapy. Yes. So how did you, and when did you begin working with him?
Well, shortly after his book was published, The Body Electric is actually a famous bestseller. It still is. And he was actually in Western New York. He lived close to Buffalo, New York, Syracuse area. And it was actually nice to correspond with him at the time. We had an experience, for example, with Elizabeth Rauscher, Robert Becker, and also myself in a small competition of designing a large coil that could resonate with the earth. In other words, pick up the Schumann resonance and therefore measure it. So we've all participated in that contest. I think Elizabeth ended up winning. She was the most experienced in that type of technology. But that was one nice exchange. And the other one basically was the fact that Bob Becker was one of the three medical doctors who, and I recite this all the time, Becker, Bassett, and Pillow. Becker, Bassett, and Pillow were the three doctors who actually patented and discovered the bone healing, bone knitting frequencies that could actually speed up either broken bone reforming or osteoporosis reversal. Both of them involved, in his case, electrodes that were put into the fracture area. And that was their invasive surgery to begin studying this effect. Well, it turns out that pulsed magnetic fields will achieve the same thing. And he points that out in his Body Electric book and also his patents. All three of the doctors patented the same effect. And the funny thing was, even the FDA had a special office for approving all of their patents because it became proliferated pretty quickly. But what was interesting, this is the 1980s I'm talking about. Well, by the 1990s, I was also interested in what commercial device was available for treatment, you know, of civilians of the commercial market. When people, as it turns out, 50% of Americans will suffer some form of osteoporosis in their later life, later years. And stress and weight-bearing exercise is the primary means to reverse that. In other words, it turns out biophysically that we need the weight-bearing exercise to cause a piezoelectric effect in the bone. Now, the bone doesn't release calcium unless it has stress, and the piezo effect then takes place. Well, it's nice that electrotherapy, pulsed EMF, can achieve the same thing. And that's also where our EM Pulsar 78 comes in. We actually followed Dr. Glenn Gordon's work years later and found a very nice pulsed EMF frequency, which is a Schumann resonance, 7.8 hertz, and also a very steep rise time on the pulse. which is also something that Robert Becker had researched as well.
Well, I know Nikola Tesla, he wrote a paper on the high-frequency oscillators for electrotherapeutic and other purposes. So in the late 1800s, there was already this awareness of electrotherapeutic instruments or technologies. And I remember coming across an article that in Sweden, there were efforts to introduce some of Tesla's technologies where they would project electromagnetic frequencies into classrooms. And it was found that this would enhance students' brain power and also promote healing. And so that was in the, I think it was around 1906. I don't know if you ever came across that newspaper article. But of course, you know, we just don't hear of that. So at some point we have to ask, well, when was it that officials started to suppress this knowledge that was emerging through Tesla and others about the applications of electrotherapy? When did that kind of suppression begin?
I was actually going to grab my book and recite the actual date. It was the early 1900s, and the book is called Bioelectromagnetic Healing, and I have so many copies around that I'm usually able to grab one even from the shelf here. And yeah, let me just do this. The history of it basically is the fact that we had what's called the Fetzner Report. And as you point out, 1898 was when the American Electrotherapeutic Association in Buffalo, New York actually was holding annual meetings that Tesla not only presented his talks about his research with Tesla coils, but also published his papers on that topic. And unfortunately, the Fetzner Report, as we're referring to it, basically became a real problem for this development of electrotherapy. And it could have been because there wasn't the possibility of monthly purchases. That's the speculation nowadays, as far as why and how the pharmaceutical companies became so much more dominant. But the history essentially tells us that the FDA and the AMA were basically keeping the development of any high voltage therapy under wraps. And the Fetzner Report was the major impetus for this type of, it's called the Flexner Report, I mispronounced it. And this was basically the effect of around 1934, the release of that. And so both the AMA and FDA became part of that, I would say, almost conspiracy to control every hospital environment to remove the electrotherapeutic possibilities. And surprisingly, homeopathy survived that suppression, but the other types of electrotherapy did not, except for the heat-related therapies.
Well, that's very helpful to know that there was this kind of struggle between proponents of electrotherapy and those that were supporting the pharmaceutical industry, and the pharmaceutical industry kind of emerged dominant. And we know how powerful they are today. So you became aware of this, and I know you worked as an engineer, an applied engineer, teaching and in the field. And then you decided, or you made a move to work for the US Patent and Trademarks Office in 1996. And you were fully aware of this kind of history of suppression and how Tesla technologies, I guess, were bore the brunt of a lot of that repression. So what made you decide to join the patent office and become a patent examiner?
Well, actually, it was sort of personal interest I had of actually reviewing the possibility of developing my own patents. And I have tried to do that. We actually did pursue one patent on antioxidant electric clothing. But the interest was personal, I would say. And it's also fascinating to be able to meet and deal with other inventors. I always find that an avenue of discovery and also creativity as well. So it was actually a good income. It provided me retirement income nowadays so that I can pursue my nonprofit venture into energy propulsion.
Well, I know that, so you worked in the patents office from 96 to 99, and then you organized the very first conference on future energy at the US State Department. And there was some kind of controversy over one of the speakers that you had invited, that he was a cold fusion expert. And I guess you just wanted to kind of do due diligence and have someone present on that. And of course, that led to a lot of controversy. And the end result was that you were kind of, the conference had to be moved from the State Department. And eventually you lost your job as a patent examiner, and a long struggle began. So why don't you explain what happened there? Why was this resistance to cold fusion so intense at that time?
You know, I still would love to understand that psychological and sociological problem which existed back then. It's almost an historic type of prejudice that was precipitated by the American Physical Society. And I say that particularly because Robert Park was the kingpin of a group of scientists that had various representatives. One actually was Dr. Zimmerman at the State Department. And then, of course, in my alma mater, the source of the Skeptical Inquirer, which is still in publication today, was Paul Kurtz's, Professor Paul Kurtz's creation. And I can go into that whole, he had an organization for investigation of the paranormal and included the free energy suppression aspect. Amazing Randy was part of that conspiracy, and they were giving lectures. I attended one of Randy's rallies, I would call them. But overall, the consciousness at that time was Bob Park had a What's New column that was emailed throughout the government, and who knows who else got it for free every week. And there were at least a half a dozen topics of little paragraphs of his opinions. And for example, a cold fusion patent application ended up at the Supreme Court. Well, what does Bob Park do in his What's New column? He announces that the Supreme Court will decide to not hear the case. And it hadn't actually happened yet, but he was already predicting that it would. Well, one of my friends, he actually was the Naval Research Lab, Scott Chubb, and I decided to do a conference call and call up Bob Park and say, why did you announce something that's not even true? And he said, well, we just preempt some of these things. And essentially what he was doing was coaxing the Supreme Court ahead of time to do something that he suggested would be appropriate, because he's a physics professor at the University of Maryland and therefore, you know, decides the way society should go scientifically. So that's my opinion of why I got fired, because as soon as the conference was supposed to be scheduled at the State Department through the, it was an open forum, the secretary's open forum, and I knew the lady who was the secretary's director of her open forum department. And so she's the one that invited me. I have a letter, an official letter that invited me to hold the conference there. Everything was scheduled except when Dr. Zimmerman decided to intervene on the behalf of Bob Park. And Bob Park, we found through the Freedom of Information Act, had really told him to kill the conference in one of his emails. So Bob Park was directing, much like we see now with the January 6th investigations, you know, Trump kind of orchestrating various things throughout the government that he thought could happen and directing people to do his will. That's exactly what happened in the year 99. And the patent office followed suit. They were embarrassed. Embarrassment is a big deal to the government, no matter how it happens, and they'll do almost anything to avoid it. Well, getting rid of me was the best answer to their problem, even though it took 6 years to get my job back. And the arbitrator wrote an 80-page summary of all the things that happened to me, including the fact that I shouldn't have been fired in the first place. And there was no precedent for conflict of interest and another minor offense that they could possibly find against me. So that's a long story short.
Right. So overall, then, after you got your job back at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, you worked there for 20 years. So you have detailed knowledge of how the patent office works. So maybe you can explain to my audience how secrecy orders work, because we know that there are almost 6,000 patent applications that are held up from secrecy orders. So how does that work? How does an inventor come up with an idea, he applies for a patent, and then all of a sudden a secrecy order is applied, and so what happens after that?
Well, actually, to back up a bit, I actually received at my desk at the USPTO various single sheets that predicted a secrecy order. And what they would do is ask the examiner to basically either explain or to confirm whatever they determined. And what I would see across the top was various agencies such as the Air Force, the Army, DOD, DIA, various acronyms of all the different military agencies that had privy to these patent applications. And essentially, once that was confirmed, either secrecy recommended or secrecy not recommended, if it is recommended, then basically it would be secretized. In other words, I could still work if I was in that department. If actually the department was across the street from me that actually had top secret clearance to do this type of work. But I would see the form ahead of time if it was not secretized. So what I'm getting to is the fact that once it's determined to be a secret patent, the patent examiner still works on it, goes through the approval process of searching, seeing if it's patentable, yes or no, whatever he does, it doesn't really matter. That's the first thing I found out. Secondly, is whether it's allowed or not allowed, still doesn't matter because it's secretized. And the outcome is that it gets placed in the vault. And the vault is essentially a low security room that's guarded and locked and essentially contains all these different, usually in that case, in a date, was paper copies. But nowadays, electronic copies, of course, that are unavailable to the public for about 50 years. And the surprise is the Federation of American Scientists, and anyone that's listening can go to FAS.org, which is the acronym for Federation of American Scientists, and there they do their annual report on the number and the categories and so forth of the secretized patents. But unfortunately, the reality is that the patent patent holder is informed that your patent has been either allowed or whatever, but it's been secretized, and therefore you can't do anything with it. You can't talk to anybody about it. You're under the order of a number of conditions that you have to even report who you talk to if you do explain what you worked on to the military agency that is now in charge of that patent. And they hold on to it for decades, literally, without necessarily any compensation to the patent holder, even if they decide to use it. So that's the inequity and the really the discrimination that a patent holder has when he invents something that transitions into the military industrial complex.
I've seen it, a number of people have pointed out that the bulk of the 6,000 patents that are held up under these secrecy orders, the majority of those either have to do with future energy, alternative energy sources, and healing, advanced healing technologies, assuming something along the lines of Tesla's electromagnetic therapy technology. So is that accurate?
I'm surprised to hear about the healing aspect. I would suspect that instead the propulsion area is what I've learned even from, I would say, scientists, attorneys that actually act as go-betweens between the military and the civilian world. In one particular case, I remember actually dealing with one of those guys at a Tesla conference when he was essentially trying to prevent the suppression of one of the presenters who was talking about Henry Morey's invention. And what I learned when Paul Brown was actually under this type of attack, so to speak, is that the energy aspect of Henry Morey's or Paul Brown's reproduction of Henry Morey's invention would probably be allowed to be commercialized, but the propulsion aspect, even of the Searle device, for example, I was told personally by this type of consultant that would probably be secretized and prevented and classified because propulsion in itself, as I've learned since then, tends to have lots of security aspects to it. For example, we can just envision a very hyper sonic type of transport. And you can keep going into sci-fi type of concepts of transportation, teleportation, and so forth. If any of those concepts are available, which lots of people in the black world have reported some of those are, we sort of can envision criminal elements taking advantage of that.
So when it comes to this propulsion aspect of Tesla technologies, I know that Thomas Townsend Brown, he discovered or found out that when very high electrostatic charges are created, that you can actually have this electrogravitic effect, or something is propelled in the direction of the positive anode of a capacitor. So the application for that has been known to be, well, if you generate sufficient electrostatic charges, you can actually have things move kind of like in an anti-gravity effect. So is that something you've been able to confirm? I know there's a debate between, well, Thomas Townsend's work, is it genuinely an electrogravitic device, or is it just based on ion wind? And people try and dismiss it as ion wind, but I think there have been experiments conducted in a vacuum that show that electrogravitics is real. But do you have any kind of insights on that?
Yes, I'm glad you're that informed. In fact, I'm just calling up the electrogravitics book that you're talking about so people will have some idea of what we're explaining. And I guess I could share a screen momentarily to narrate it. And really the ion wind option for what you're referring to is actually explained in my second book, Electrogravitics Volume 2. What I'm showing right now is Electrogravitics Number 1, and the second volume is perhaps going to show up here. Yeah, and they're both on the Amazon as well. But the comparison between what Townsend Brown did and what various people that have worked, for example, Tim Ventura has built one of the lifters, for example. And actually there other people have worked with that too, where you charge the leading edge of any type of circular device, even a saucer shape, with positive voltage, high voltage. Like even the B-2 bomber has the leading edge charged to high voltage. And then the back end would be negative electrons coming out. That actually has been shown not to be a major contributor to the electrogravitic effect. Because the electrogravitic, and I cite the, and I reproduce the Air Force Research Lab, AFRL, who did this investigation and wrote up the report. So your question has been answered in my second volume of Electrogravitics 2. But it's fascinating to deal with that. And I can tell another quick story in regards to that. I was at a space society conference in Orem, Utah years ago, and Bob Zubrin was actually my sitting right next to me on my left side on a panel discussion. And it was the it was the day of the conference, but the night before I had talked to a military contractor who had worked with electrogravitics. So what happened was, as I'm trying to talk about on the panel discussion, electrogravitics and the effect that should be more well recognized, Bob Zubrin was skeptical. And he works for NASA and he's got some books out about how to get to Mars. And he's very famous and I respect him a lot. But his opinion was to interrupt me and say, oh, we should be talking about more conventional things instead of electrogravitics. So I said, and I remember the fellow was in the audience that I talked to the night before, the military contractor. I said, I forgot his name, but I call him Joe. I said, Joe, can you stand up and tell us what you told me last night? And he stands up and it's on the videotape. I levitated a hockey puck with high voltage. And it was pulsed high voltage that he did it with. So Bob Zubrin shut up right away. And I was vindicated at that point. But pulsed electrogravitics is my answer to the Townsend Brown work with static electricity. And I need to cite one more example of that. In my second book, Electrogravitics 2, I reproduce how I control gravity, quote unquote, article from Townsend Brown, how I control gravity. Well, in that article, he shows all the different apparatuses that he built and the polarities that he used on like pendulum that were polarized. Well, what he reports in the article is that when I turn the electricity on, high voltage on, he says it moved. But then it went back to the original starting point. And he says, I don't understand why. Well, we do nowadays. It's called pulsed electrogravitics. You have to keep pulsing it to get it to move. And that's what the military contractor did. And so he constantly created the force, which I discovered Dr. Jeff Amenko from West Virginia University called it the electrokinetic effect. And it turns out neither one knew each other, but electrokinetics was what Townsend Brown patented and Dr. Jeff Amenko explained.
One of the 2001 Disclosure Project witnesses that Stephen Greer got to come forward was Mark McCandlish. And I know you got to talk and work with Mark a bit. And of course, he had an encounter, or he was told about three anti-gravity devices that were shown at an air show in 1988, and they were operational, and they appeared to be kind of like there on display for potential customers, and they seemed to be based on this electrogravitic effect that you've just described, that could be traced back to the work of Thomas Townsend Brown. So you got to talk with Mark McCandlish a bit. Did you ever kind of find out about his source, Brad Sorensen? Did you ever get to talk to him, who was the original source for that? And how credible was Mark McCandlish's Brad Sorensen's information about that air show back in 1988?
That's actually a very interesting story overall. And I'm interested in perhaps showing one of the examples of that. Actually, it's in the second volume of Electrolytics 2, an illustration of the saucer that we're talking about. And Mark's illustration of that, what we find on the internet is a bunch of Air Force examples of saucers that really are not exactly the same as we're describing. But I guess we have one here that is almost similar. Perhaps this is a 1950s example of one that's declassified. Okay, so let me go ahead and share that screen just to give people an idea if they're interested in seeing what we're referring to. But the idea of the, what he called it as reproduction, alien reproduction vehicle, ARV, what it contained essentially was in Mark McCandlish's drawing, on the very bottom were a whole bunch of different sections, very similar to this drawing, although not the same, of sections of capacitor banks. And what I found very intriguing about that was not only do we have the capacitor banks in sections radially around the saucer, but we also had in Mark's drawing, essentially the rotating distributor, much like the car distributor of high voltage of older times, when we actually had a rotating spark generator in the distributor cap. Well, that turns out to be a confirmation of my Electrolytics 2 book describing electrokinetics, pulsed electrokinetics, where, and as Mark told me, three sections in a kind of a star-shaped triangular form would be fired at any one time and then moved over to the next section, and so forth. So it constantly produced a downward force, or in other words, an upward reaction force on the vehicle. And his, Brad Sorensen's eyewitness report was a couple of these 1950s rivet type of structures were actually levitating in the closed environment at Norton Air Force Base in the 1980s. So this is the best and the closest that I got to, including talking to Hal Puthoff about it. And I talked to Hal Puthoff about it on the phone. He sent me an email, which I got permission to reproduce in the book. And I show it in my slideshows, that he says he confirmed Brad Sorensen's report, and he put it in his grave basket of possibly true events. So that's about as close as I got to confirming Mark McCandlish's essentially amazing story of how pulsed electrokinetics possibly was actually functioning.
Okay, so that's very interesting. So Hal Puthoff confirmed Brad Sorensen's story to some degree. That's quite significant.
Okay, at least corroborated it with other eyewitnesses. Yeah.
So as far as this kind of technology is concerned, anti-gravity, you worked at the patents office for 20 years. Did you personally ever come across patent applications that discuss that were kind of like held up under secrecy orders? I mean, are you allowed to talk about that?
If I did, I couldn't talk about it. But to be honest, no, I did not, because I was in the measuring and testing area. And actually, I was, after my, I call it an arrest, but after my dismissal and reinstatement, I was literally prohibited from even going across the street to the classified area to talk to friends I knew over there. So including a UFO buff investigator. But yeah, it became a real problem for me to even pursue that on a hobby basis. So nope, never came across them. I found interesting patents. You know, there were some dealing with like faster than light that became a point of contention, even for the commissioner, for example, and which is a big scandal. But anyways, unfortunately, and I would say maybe fortunately, I did not. So I'm not under a restriction in talking about it.
Okay. Well, one interesting development, of course, has been Elon Musk and him creating the Tesla car company, an all-electric company, as we all know. Now, has he shown any interest at all in these kinds of Tesla technologies that we've been discussing? I mean, is for example, the electrogravitic effect, is that something that Elon Musk or anyone in his company has ever shown any interest in? I know you have established your own nonprofit organization, Integrity Research Institute. So during your work with that, with the Institute, did Elon Musk or anyone in his company show any interest on these kinds of innovative propulsion technologies that you've been working on?
No, I've heard lots of rumors that he might be interested, but so far I've not been able to confirm it. And so I would say no, as far as I know, that is not on his agenda of things to pursue. But it's interesting because I had another experience at NASA Goddard Space Center, which is just around the corner from where I live in College Park, Maryland. And I went to one of their Goddard lectures and actually talked to a fairly senior director of some of the research projects there. And what I usually do is I wait until they're done and then catch them in the hallway as they're leaving, even with the conference still going on. And so in that case, I was fortunate to do that. And one of my first questions usually is to the person of that stature in a federal government organization dealing with propulsion or energy, is I say, do you have access to classified reports? And in many cases, they don't. And even if they do, sometimes they're not taking advantage of looking at them, or they don't review them. In his case, he said no, which I found very unfortunate. And so when I tried to talk about electrovitics, even give a copy of my book, he wasn't interested because it seemed too speculative. Even that breakthrough propulsion program that NASA had, he was a rocket man. And the breakthrough propulsion was so much fluff and fantasy that he criticized it openly to my face. So that's how NASA is divided, even internally, with something that we know is advanced propulsion. And of course, Harold White is another good example with his pursuing of various breakthrough propulsion techniques. But he's isolated as well, even though it's possible that one of his breakthroughs might be quite successful.
So just shifting gears a little bit now, we're kind of moving from propulsion to free energy. I know Nikola Tesla came up with a patent on a method of utilizing radiant energy in 1901. So what is radiant energy and how does that relate to future energy or zero point energy?
Oh, that's a very good question. Actually, that gives me a chance to promote my other book. And I could probably do that if I go to my author's page, but I'll just hold up the book and see if it actually shows. Nikola Tesla's Electricity Unplugged. That's my latest book. It's on Adventures Unlimited Press. And essentially wireless transmission of power is what you're referring to. And in both of my books on Tesla, Harnessing the Wheelwork of Nature, and also in this one, I have articles that, especially, for example, Elizabeth Rauscher's article in the Harnessing book, that refer to the fact that the magnetosphere and the ionosphere communicate with each other. And when we get to the point of whether or not radiant energy that Tesla talked about, for example, the magnifying transmitter, which is also the name of an article that Andrew Poharich published. Actually, he had a book that I summarized in excerpt form in my book, dealing with the magnifying transmitter. The speculation is that is the Earth the source of the energy that could make wireless transmission of power over unity? Or is, as you suggest, zero point energy perhaps, or the quantum vacuum being an extra impetus for that? Well, to me, I did my thesis on zero point energy as a practical conversion technique. And what we find today is that there's negative energy states that are below zero point energy. Zero point energy is sort of like the surface of a body of water that's behind me. And when that has waves in it, which it does constantly, those are actually apparent in various macroscopic forms. For example, liquid helium never freezes, even if you get below 1 degree absolute. There's lots of different sources of zero point energy that are available. And even the quantum effect of them, and geckos and various insects that can stick to surfaces, those are the results of the Casimir force that's contributing to that adhesion effect. But overall, we would suggest that the magnifying transmitter or the radiant energy invention of Tesla's referred to what he called space energy, energy that's available throughout space. And those are almost exactly his words. And I would say he's referring to the quantum vacuum. And he's absolutely right that as we learn more about the quantum vacuum and the conversion of it, I would even suggest that, for example, the invention of Dr. Sabato, which I can call up here for people that are not familiar with it. Dr. Sabato is one of my heroes in this regard, where here's the University of Arkansas, if I can share this screen and show people. The fascinating thing about Dr. Paul Sabato is that he's actually built a circuit that generates clean, limitless power from graphene. Well, on the surface, this seems like a conundrum. What does graphene have to do with it? You know, why is that converting any energy? Well, it turns out graphene, which is only a couple atoms thick, oscillates continually at room temperature. So in general, the article shows here that there's thermal energy, as this little video also shows. It's a 40-second video. Let's see if I can get a full screen version of it. Anyways, this is showing the movement of electrons through the circuit with diodes and capacitors, one capacitor and diode, which allows for the oscillation to have an effect on a circuit. So Sabato literally took about 20 years to perfect this invention, 10 years just to verify that the graphene was able to be isolated, and then another 10 years to design a circuit with a capacitor so that it could actually then store the energy and make use of it. So to me, this is very fascinating because what he did was now employ a company to produce a microchip, which he shows and he's actually holding in his hand, which is going to be released this year. And I'm on the mailing list to be informed. As soon as I can buy one, I'm going to put it to the test and see how long it will last. There's my answer.
So with wireless transmission of energy, now, one of the things that I know you have said is that that is 95% efficient, that what Tesla had come up with was 95% efficient, whereas wired transmission of electricity through power lines, transformers, and so forth, that was only 33% efficient. So, you know, the question is, why aren't we using wireless transmission much more than we are?
Well, I'm actually happy to tell the short answer or the long answer. the short answer is that it still hasn't worked. And I'm happy to pursue that because obviously I've written more than one book on the topic. And the companies that have pursued this invention actually involve two different companies. One was in Texas. There's a New Zealand-based startup I'm seeing on the Google search for this. There's companies that are constantly looking at ways to capitalize on wireless transmission because of what you refer to is the efficiency is predictable to be quite high. So this is a big incentive for people to improve on it. Now, the James Quorum is one of my heroes. In fact, I have actually it's almost 100-page article of Jim Quorum's in my wireless Nikola Tesla's Electricity Unplugged book that describes his work on the wave propagation, surface propagation effect that he actually found was even more important for the transmission of the electricity than through the atmosphere. And so this was another area of pursuit that he now is involved in. And the company that had hired him originally to capitalize on this ended up letting him go because they thought they could do it all themselves without him, which is really unfortunate to see this corporate struggle for power when Jim Quorum obviously is an expert in this technology. So he's published plenty of information on it, and he's researched and proven the transmission over 20 kilometers at least was very efficiently received. But overall, the ability to commercialize and make it profitable is, I think, what's stopping it at this point.
Well, I know there's a lot of events that you've organized in the past, conferences on future energy. So is that a yearly event you organize? I mean, do you have some more planned for 2022 or 2023?
Actually, we don't at this point. COVID has sort of put a damper on the organization in person. And what was kind of exciting is a couple of years ago, we had COFE 12, which is the 12th Conference on Future Energy. And it was scheduled for Albuquerque, but it was in 2020, right when COVID was hitting. And I was cooperating with Stephen Ellswick at that point, and who's now continued with his Tesla Tech Extraordinary Technology Conferences. However, he canceled his, and I said, no, I could still probably hold it online. And all my speakers were still lined up. So I did a 2-day conference using Zoom and actually recorded a few of the presentations. Everything went seamlessly and it's now available on YouTube. So anyone can search my name, COFE12, COFE number 12, and see any of the videos for free. So that I think is a more convenient mode of communication for any speakers because we have people from around the world that participated, even Dr. Ludwig from Germany, and it turned out to be, as I say, a very well-used conference. Yeah.
Well, I know you've really established quite a reputation as an expert on free energy, electromagnetic healing technologies, and electrogravitic propulsion systems with all the books and the conferences and the papers that you've written. So if people want to kind of find out more about that, what's the best website for them to go to?
The best website I would suggest is integrity-research.org. There's a hyphen between integrity and research. Integrity-research.org. And then the bioelectromagnetic materials and products are available on a separate website, which is reachable from that homepage, called bioenergydevice.org. And bioenergydevice.org is the main website for that.
Well, I want to thank you for being on the show. That was really very informative, and I think you've helped educate people a lot about the applications of Tesla technology. So thank you.
Thank you, too. Thank you for having me.
You have been listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala. Please remember to like, share, and subscribe to this channel. Join or start a conversation in the comments. Take the time to explore the vast library of best-selling books, webinars, and podcasts by Dr. Sala. Visit exopoliticstoday.com.